This is VOA's International Edition. Today is Friday, June 14th. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the United States says Iran is responsible for the attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Democrats and even some Republicans are rebuking comments from President Trump about accepting foreign assistance in his campaign.
If a foreign government comes to you as a public official and offers to help your campaign, giving you anything of value, whether it be money or information on your opponent, the right answer is no.
Also ahead, Miley Cyrus is on a roll with her alter ego. It's all on today's International Edition. Two oil tankers were damaged in attacks Thursday in the Gulf of Oman, a strategic sea lane off the coast of Iran. The Norwegian Maritime Authority said three explosions were reported on the Norwegian-owned tanker front at Altair after a suspected attack on the Kokuka Courageous, a tanker owned by the Hamburg, Germany-based Bernhard Schulte Ship Management. The U.S. Navy's Bahrain-based U.S. Fifth Fleet provided assistance after receiving distress calls from both tankers about an hour apart. Both vessels were on fire. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke about the condemned the attacks.
Our policy remains an economic and diplomatic effort to bring Iran back to the negotiating table at the right time, to encourage a comprehensive deal that addresses the broad range of threats. Threats today apparent for all the world to see, to peace and security.
Well, joining us now is Benham Ben Talablu with Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for being with us. Why are authorities convinced that Iran is responsible for these attacks?
Well, the secretary laid out several patterns of behavior that would make this assault on the two ships in the Gulf of Oman from Thursday a.m. almost entirely consistent with Iran's modus operandi and Iran's capabilities and intentions. That being said, there wasn't any kind of slideshow of evidence or any kind of chain of attribution of this weapon, that target sort of thing that you see with the Iranian material display exhibit that the U.S. has a joint base Anacostia-Bulling. But it would behoove the administration to also put that out. But given that Iran was blamed for this just days after the one-year anniversary of the U.S. leaving the deal, I believe that the pattern, as the administration says, is consistent with what Iran is doing, which is escalating. Iran is signaling that it has options in the face of maximum pressure. And unfortunately, we're seeing the regime's true nature here.
But if Iran is feeling the pressure of the sanctions, why would they act worse? Why would they do more provocative things?
That's exactly right. If Iran is feeling the pain of the sanctions, they want to respond in the face of those sanctions because Iran is trying to undo a narrative. The narrative is that maximum pressure does generate changes, albeit it takes a very long time. So Iran is trying to say before that narrative crystallizes that you cannot afford to escalate against me, that you cannot afford to enforce sanctions against me, and that it has offsets to American pressure, and that it is willing to bet that it can see its retaliation policy through better than the U.S. can see its pressure policy through. And so the whole goal here by Iran trying to show that it has options, by Iran's persistent desire for asymmetric, low-intensity conflict, whether it's on land or now as we've seen in the months since the one-year anniversary of the U.S. leaving the nuclear deal, that it has these escalation options at sea as well. So Iran wants the U.S. to swerve here, and it wants to say that it can win the battle of resolve.
Why would something like this happen as Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is meeting with the Ayatollah Khomeini to try to be some sort of mediator between the U.S. and Iran? Why would they do it then, of all times? They're saying we didn't do this, and why would we when in this situation?
That's a great point. But look at what the Iranian press put out the other day, just as Abe was landing. There was a former Iranian diplomat who was quoted in a state outlet, essentially saying that they understand that what Japan fears most is escalation in the Gulf. Right? Japan doesn't only get its oil from Iran, even though it has cut those exports to zero or essentially zero. Japan is still reliant on importing almost all of its energy, and a lot of its crude comes from the Persian Gulf area. And this is Iran making good on its old threat, again, trying to undo something, that if Iran can't export oil, everyone else in the Gulf is going to have a hard time exporting oil, and that they will be denied this privilege, this access. So while Japan is reliant on that, rather than seeing the Abe visit as to what we were watching in the West, which is perhaps carrying a message, being the mediator between the U.S. and Iran, you know, know, Abe's close personal relationship with Trump, using that to tell Khamenei something privately. It's the opposite. It's the Iranians standing firm, even in the face of their friends, threatening the interests of their friends, and having that spook their friends, drive their friends back into Washington, take advantage of that special relationship between Abe and Trump, and have Abe besiege the administration to swerve, to stop the sanctions campaign, that Abe and anyone else who imports Gulf oil can't afford to see prices spike, insurance premiums spike. And this way, Iran can stick American partners back on America and show that the pressure campaign has little to no international support. In fact, I think it's a pretty well-calibrated move by Iran.
Do you feel like this could be the beginning of what we could be entering into some sort of war?
I always think there's a chance of unintended escalation with the U.S. and Iran. Even if these two countries were nothing, if there was no pressure campaign, and if there was no Iranian response, if there was no Iranian terrorism, given the political hostility, simply in the rhetoric, and Iran's deep-seated strategic desire under the auspices of the Islamic Republic to upend the regional balance of power arrayed against it in the Middle East for the past 40 years, you have these two navies, these two countries operating in these narrow bodies of water, it's entirely possible that unintended escalation can come from that. And then you layer on, of course, Iran's desire to, you know, signal its resolve against America, and Iran finding new and creative ways to threaten shipping without actually having to close the Strait of Hormuz. I do worry about the prospects of escalation, but it's important to have the causal chain correct and not just see this as a pure response to 1 year ago and realize what the regime is doing here. For many years, the goal of the Islamic Republic in the Persian Gulf has been to drive out foreign forces. And now we're just seeing the newest manifestation of that.
All right, that's been a Ben Talablu with Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Senate halts efforts to prevent arms sales to Bahrain, Qatar. Cyprus's killer exposes a bias against female domestic workers. Nicaragua frees a top news journalist from jail, and families flee the Sudan war only to flee again in Libya. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Hong Kong's government closed many government offices today after protests rocked the city center yesterday. Protesters demanding that the government scrap plans to pass a controversial bill on extradition. My colleague Kate Pound Dawson spoke to Aaron Hale in Hong Kong for an update on the situation.
Early this morning, the protests really wrapped up for the day. There was very intense rain, and I think people were very tired. So when I got to the area around, you know, 8 or 9 a.m., where there had been huge protests just last night, most people were gone, and there were some people who were still there cleaning up, you know, boxes, taking supplies back. They didn't say that the protests were over, but they said they were just, you know, going to regroup. The protests aren't officially, well, yesterday's weren't officially organized, but sort of an unofficial organizer, Civil Human Rights Front, has said that there will be a march on Sunday. So things will definitely continue.
Now, what is expected next from the government?
So the government, it's unclear. They've closed the legislature today, and it will be closed again tomorrow. So they're just delaying it as much as possible. Carrie Lam yesterday did speak to the people of Hong Kong through a Facebook video, and she did go on TV, and she basically chastised them for protesting, and I think continues to push the line that they don't understand what this law is. So I do not think she's going to back down. The vote is still officially set for June 20th, but it's possible that will get delayed. They have until like mid early July, when the legislature usually goes on summer recess. So they could possibly just keep pushing it back, because they have set about 66 hours for debate officially, or they did before the protests happened, and it's unclear if they're still planning to do that, because the bill hasn't passed its second reading yet, so it needs to do that to continue.
Okay. Now, what has China said about all of this?
China has said previously, I think yesterday, that this is an internal matter, and has asked for foreign countries to stay out of it. Today they were very critical of some comments by the European Union that, you know, basically said that the EU still had concerns about the extradition bill and urged sort of Hong Kong to respect the right of protesters. In the state media, they've really emphasized the violence of the protests, and they made them sound, you know, a lot more like riots and hoodlums. And they've also really been pushing this line that there's a protest online right now with 900,000 people's signatures saying that they support the extradition bill, but it's unclear if that petition is reliable.
That's VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson speaking to reporter Aaron Hale in Hong Kong. Well, the task of replacing British Prime Minister Theresa May began Thursday with the first round of voting. May resigned after failing to reach a deal for Brexit, the name of the UK plans to leave the European Union. Joining us for that is London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, tell us what happened.
This is for Conservative MPs to start eliminating the very crowded field of candidates to lead the Conservative Party. And, of course, whoever leads the Conservative Party will then go on to replace Theresa May as Prime Minister. And we've seen so many candidates nominating themselves and then dropping out in the last week because they felt they didn't have a chance. But today, former London Mayor and Foreign Minister, current Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, a highly controversial figure, took a major lead in the first round of these votes, again, to take over the leadership of the Conservative Party and also replace Theresa May. And it was quite a landslide. He got 114 votes compared to second place is Jeremy Hunt, who got 43, and Michael Gove, who has been plagued by the announcement and his own admission that he did drugs, did cocaine earlier in life at a much younger age. He got 37 votes. So that's quite a landslide any way you look at it.
Why is Boris so popular, do you think?
Boris is very popular within members of Parliament, and it's important to distinguish that he isn't necessarily popular in the populace. He's popular within his own political circle, and that's because Conservative MPs are very worried about losing their seats. We have a situation in the UK, not unlike other parts of Europe, not unlike the US, where we're seeing very extreme parties emerge and very extreme allegiances and alliances emerge as we have divisive events like Brexit that really are putting people at opposite ends of the spectrum. So they think Boris is an election winner. Boris won two elections as a mayor in London. This is a traditionally Labour constituency, and Boris is a Conservative. So he's seen as someone who can help win elections, and he's also seen as the person who can deliver Brexit. Conservative MPs believe that if they don't have a leader who command votes for himself and for others and who can deliver Brexit, they will have an already marginalized constituency go to other parties, trade allegiances. So that means that in the north, where you have people who are a lot more concerned about immigration and jobs, if you have marginal conservative voters in the north and you have a leader who is not going to turn it out at election time, you could lose those voters to the Brexit Party. In the South, there's a resurgent Lib Dem Party, and they could take a lot of the marginal voters. And this is not a concern that is limited, by the way, to the Conservative Party. The left, the Labour Party, has the exact same worries. They have marginal voters, too. So again, you have these two traditional parties that are both concerned because all of a sudden there are other options through the Lib Dem Party and the Brexit Party. And once you get these marginal voters, if you don't keep them engaged and you don't have a really compelling leader in your party, you're going to lose those votes. And so I think they're worried that if they cannot deliver Brexit, it could spell the end of the Conservative Party. Now, that's not exactly true. I doubt that would ever happen. But certainly they would lose enormous power.
What happens now? What happens next?
So this is just the beginning of this elimination process. There will also be what they call ballots, or for lack of a better word, votes, next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday within the Conservative Party to narrow the field. And each time, any candidate with fewer than 17 votes will be eliminated. So while we can say today that, yes, Boris had this incredible victory, 114, and you know, the second place winner got only 43. As you narrow the field, obviously those margins will become smaller and smaller. So anyone with fewer than 17 votes will be eliminated each time. So on Tuesday, on Wednesday, and Thursday, and then the final two candidates will be put to a vote by the entire Conservative Party on June 22nd. The final results will be announced within the month, so sometime before the end of July, because that's when Parliament breaks for summer. So that's when we'll know who will replace Theresa May as Prime Minister.
All right, that's London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Democrats are hammering President Trump over his saying to ABC News that he'd be open to accepting a foreign power's help if in getting reelected. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president said in an exclusive interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos that if offered dirt on a 2020 opponent,
I think I'd want to hear it.
And while he might report it to the FBI, he'd be under no obligation. Democratic contenders are blasting that, with Joe Biden calling it a threat to national security. This morning, the president tweets he talks with foreign governments every day about everything, writing, "Should I immediately call the FBI? How ridiculous." He adds, "I'd never be trusted again." Sagar Magani, Washington.
Well, the 2020 presidential election is still way off, but President Trump already appears to be setting his sights on Democratic presidential contender and current front runner, Joe Biden. Nearly two dozen other Democratic candidates are targeting Biden as well, just weeks before the first monthly debates among the party's contenders. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone provides a status report on the 2020 presidential campaign from Washington.
So please welcome Vice President Joe Biden.
In the early voting state of Iowa, Democratic Party frontrunner Joe Biden wastes little time in going after President Donald Trump.
But this is a guy who does everything to separate and frighten people. It's about fear and loathing. It's about what the way he calls people the names he calls them. No president has done something like that, for God's sake. I mean, it's bizarre. And it's damaging.
Well, thank you very much.
Biden is apparently on the president's mind as well, as Trump considers possible challengers for next year.
Joe never got more than 1%, except Obama took him off the trash heap, and now it looks like he's failing. It looks like his friends from the left are going to overtake him pretty soon. But I heard his whole campaign is to hit Trump.
Polls show Biden leading the Democratic presidential field, with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders generally trailing in second place.
So this is what you've got left over.
Among those on the rise is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, with a focus on policy specifics and passion.
On the question of gun violence, I will be fearless. We will fight side by side, and we will protect our children.
The other thing that's at stake right now.
Also gaining is South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who offers the party a younger alternative.
New thinking, bold action, a focus on the future. I'm running for president because of the seriousness of the moment that we're living in.
Trump has emerged as the central issue in the Democratic primary battle, which appears to be benefiting Biden, says analyst Larry Sabato.
A large majority tell pollsters they want, above all, someone who will beat Trump. They are willing to take a nominee with whom they disagree on a wide variety of issues because they will agree with that candidate more than they will agree with Trump.
Recent polls show Biden beating Trump by a wide margin, but the president is eager to dismiss the entire Democratic field as too far to the left.
Every day the Democrat Party is becoming more and more unhinged and more extreme. They're going crazy. Do you love it? I sort of love it.
Trump is hoping Democrats nominate a hard left candidate, says Larry Sabato.
The Republicans and Trump want to make the Democrats overconfident. If they're overconfident, they're more likely to nominate a candidate who's well to the left, pleasing the Democratic activists, but nearly guaranteeing a defeat in November of 2020. So that's the hidden agenda behind what you're hearing from the Trump camp.
The 2020 race moves into a new phase later this month with the first official Democratic debates featuring 20 presidential contenders. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, a nonprofit environmental group working to save our oceans has just published an investigative report. Oceana published and demonstrating the power of technology to shine a light on possible illegal fishing, forced labor, and human trafficking at sea. Joining us to talk more about it, about the report, is Oceana campaign manager and author of the report, Lacey Malarkey. Explain exactly what this report is revealing.
So Oceana used the Global Fishing Watch mapping platform to investigate three vessels that have a known history of illicit activity, like illegal fishing, forced labor, and human trafficking, and we found some suspicious behaviors that emerged from using this technology, like vessels remaining at sea for extended periods of time, vessels evading public tracking systems, or avoiding ports known to enforce regulations. So it's these suspicious activities that are linked to illegal fishing and human rights abuses that now we can target to identify these illicit activities.
The illegal fishing issue and also, of course, human rights issues at sea, I'm assuming we're talking about trafficking. Obviously, we've been hearing a lot about human trafficking, but apparently a lot of this is coming by boat?
Yeah, so illegal fishing is a multi-billion dollar industry. Estimated losses of $10 to $23 billion every year to illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. Now, this is all off the books, ignoring any domestic or international fisheries laws, and it's really undermining the honest fishermen and seafood businesses that are forced to compete with this illegal product in the market. And when we're talking about human trafficking, it's actually really linked with illegal fishing. So these vessels that are already evading the law are going to try to cut down costs by using forced labor or other forms of cheaper labor to try to make a profit. Now, human trafficking is actually the fastest growing transnational criminal enterprise in the world, generating $150 billion every year and enslaving an estimated 21.9 million people.
This would give authorities the capability of cutting those numbers.
Yeah, so technologies like Global Fishing Watch not only let us detect suspicious activities, but also enable us to investigate them further. So governments can then use tools like this to do risk-based inspection and enforcement of suspicious vessels at a larger scale than was possible before.
What is it about this technology? Is it sort of like a hidden camera, or how does it work?
Yeah, so Global Fishing Watch uses this public broadcast signal. It's called Automatic Identification System, and it's transmitted from individual vessels. It's like a GPS signal. It's picked up by satellites, and so Global Fishing Watch then harnesses all of the signals using machine learning to then distill down exactly where, based on a vessel's location and activity, where it might be fishing. And then we can also detect other types of events as well when vessels are meeting up to exchange goods, and sometimes this can facilitate illegal fish laundering or can enable human rights at sea. So we're really using the power of machine learning and satellite technology to understand what's happening really far from our coast, out in the middle of the ocean.
How do you plan to convince authorities they should be using this equipment? Have they shown interest, or how do you actually get it to be put into action?
The technology that powers Global Fishing Watch was originally intended as a safety mechanism, so it actually improves vessels' safety at sea. It keeps them from running into each other. They can see each other a lot better than they could using other technologies. And so a lot of vessels voluntarily use this, and then governments require their fishing vessels to transmit it as well. And a lot of governments are using this technology to monitor their waters and to enforce their waters to make sure all vessels are following the rules.
All right, that's Lacey Malarkey, manager of the Illegal Fishing and Transparency Department of the organization called Oceana. She's also the author of this new report on technology and how it can catch lawbreakers. The European Space Agency is using satellite imagery to document the status of ice flows around the world from Greenland to Antarctica. The images illustrate just how quickly the world's ice is turning into water. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
The frozen water parts of the planet have a name, the cryosphere. And for the past few decades, the European Space Agency has been using satellites like Sentinels 2 and 3 to gauge the status of the cryosphere. The news isn't good.
The last century, we've seen quite dramatic changes in these different elements of the cryosphere. Notably, we've seen significant losses in Arctic sea ice. We've seen decline in the volume of ice locked up in glaciers, and we've also been witnessing changes in the large ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica. The consequence, of course, is that sea level is rising as water is transferred from ice on land into the ocean.
The red parts of this image show ice loss in Greenland. This is the Brunt Ice Shelf in Antarctica. And this imagery shows the retreat of the Columbia Glacier in Alaska. The disappearance of the cryosphere has all kinds of implications for humanity.
Glaciers have a huge impact on the population on Earth, particularly in Southeast Asia, where millions of people are dependent on mountain water resources.
And a recent study suggests Earth's glaciers are losing 369 billion tons of snow and ice annually.
During the summer season, we see the melting of the glacier and the mountain snowpack. This, of course, releases water, which is used for irrigation in the fields. It's used for generating hydroelectric power, and it's also used for drinking water. And so we're very much concerned with how climate warming has an impact on the seasonal stream flow and the way in which the water resource can be managed in the future.
During the past 50 years, the same study found that the world has lost 9.6 trillion metric tons of its icy covering. And as the ice melts, it reflects less of the sun's heat, which can lead to a runaway melting process. Scientists hope these images could help educate politicians who are drafting policies to fight climate change. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Pop star Miley Cyrus has an alter ego. In a new video for the song On a Roll, Cyrus plays the role of Ashley O, a pink-haired, pop music-obsessed woman. It's a character she portrays in the episode of Netflix's Black Mirror. The show debuted in 2016, but apparently the new episodes they just released, and the one with Cyrus in particular, are getting unhappy reviews from fans, with some calling it underwhelming and even corny. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Oh,
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blames Iran for Thursday's attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman.